Hello, everyone, and welcome this week to the Healing of Agape. This week is the first segment of a multi-part segment that we're having on the topic of consciousness with some of who I consider to be some of the leading thinkers in the world on this topic. Today we have with us Dr. Edgar Mitchell. How are you, Dr. Mitchell?
I'm great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on.
Good to meet you.
Why don't you give, for all those people that aren't as old as we are, all of those young kids out there, why don't you tell them just a little bit about you before we get started and how you came to be where you are right now with consciousness?
Well, I didn't, this consciousness bit, I became interested in, as a scientist, I became interested in perception, in our perceptions. I became interested in what used to be called parapsychology, and some still call it that. And that was when I was just in the astronaut corps and getting ready to go to the moon. And before that, however, back up a little bit, I was started flying when I was about 13 years old, and that was in 1943. And doing it because I wanted to. I washed airplanes at the airport during some flight time, and stayed with me for, ended up having a career in aviation, although that wasn't my, where I was really going. I was graduated from Carnegie Mellon, what's now Carnegie Mellon, used to be called Carnegie Tech back in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
when the Korean War was on, and I was headed, thought I was going into business or into industry as a manager, but I got, was about to be drafted, so I enlisted in the Navy, and spent part of the Korean War as a naval officer and a Navy pilot, and ended up in the 50s as a test pilot. And about that time, Sputnik went up, the Soviet, first Soviet spacecraft. And I realized we humans would be right behind robot spacecraft. And that might be an interesting thing to do, so I set my cap on going into space. And in the 1950s, 1957. And I was selected in 1966 after getting my doctor's degree from MIT and some more test pilot experience. And I was selected into the Apollo program in 1966 and asked to be specialized in the lunar module, which I was granted that permission, and started my tour of backup crew and prime crew and got to fly Apollo 14 in 1971. And like many of us, had a very powerful experience on looking at Earth from space. And as a scientist, that pushed me to want to consider this issue of consciousness, and because I'd become interested in parapsychology and perception and the various modes of our, how we gather information. So in a nutshell, that's Eva, that's a quick story.
I'm curious, when it happened to me back in 95, and when it happened to me, for about a month or two afterwards, I got a real giddy feeling. Did that happen to you too? Did you get a giddy feeling?
Well, there have been times when I've had transcendent experience, I guess that's a proper word, and where you feel, yes, it's very ebullient. You feel light. You feel a great deal of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, curiosity,
mm-hmm.
what's going on here, what's this all about? And I have been able to repeat that experience many times. And yes, I call it a bliss feeling, an ecstasy feeling.
Yes. Is it something that you can call upon, or is it something that's spontaneous when it repeats?
Well, I can call upon it, but not generally in the throes of a high-pressure business day. If I
right.
can get away, meditate a bit, and get myself right with the world, yes, I can
mm-hmm.
generally pull that experience back.
Okay. All right. So what I've done is, you know, we're going to have a few other people, Dean Radden and Charles Tart and Bill Tiller and Fred Wolf and Norm Shealy. And so what I've done is I've composed some questions that I'm going to present to each one of you. And the first one that I'd like to ask you is, do you think that What is your definition of mind?
Of what, please?
What would your definition of mind be? Do you think that the mind thinks?
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing that word.
Oh, can you not hear me?
I'm not hearing that word clearly.
Okay. The first question would be, what was your definition of mind? You know, like your mind that you think with, and do you think the mind thinks?
Well, I think it's just a word that describes the process of thinking, remembering, intending, and it's an abstract concept rather than a physical concept, like brain, which refers to matter.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, mind is simply that abstract concept referring to our thought process, our perceptions, our thought process, and the abstractions that's in it there too.
So if I understand you correctly, your definition of mind is certainly not that of the tangible brain, but as a intangible.
No, that is correct.
Okay.
No, I do not identify mind simply with brain, but it goes beyond that. And that, of course, takes us into the field of quantum mechanics, where we start to talk about non-local effects of mind and brain. And perhaps we'll get to that later on.
Yeah, go ahead. Elaborate on that. I'd love for you to go into that.
Well, I'm very convinced now that in these later years, and I have been convinced for many years, that much of the process that we see in our perception and our mental phenomena are non-local processes and properly described by quantum mechanics and quantum non-locality, which means that distance is not an issue. And, I will have to describe non-locality in order to get this idea across. Non-locality is the experimentally understood process that if two subatomic particles are ever in contact with each other and then go apart from each other, they maintain what is called quantum correlation, which means wherever they go across the universe, one is in connection with the other, and if you do something to one, the other one instantly knows about it. Now, I believe that the most basic aspect of perception or awareness has to do with that phenomenon at the quantum level, and it's non-local. Now, I'm afraid I may have lost many of your listeners at this point, but that's where it is in my mind.
I understand, and I happen to agree with you on that one. Do you believe that information that you're talking about there would be encoded within frequencies?
Well, I don't like to say it quite that way, Eva.
You got to remember that I'm not a scientist, so I'm a little bit limited to my vocabulary, so I kind of have to use some hermeneutics here to describe kind of what I'm talking about.
Information,
so bear with me.
Information, in its most basic definition, is a pattern of energy. For example, if you look into the heavens and see what we call the Big Dipper or the Little Dipper in the northern stars at night, that is a pattern of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And we give it a name. We call it a Big Dipper, the Little Dipper. Or if we look at any place in the heavens and we look at these configuration of stars, that's information coming to us. And we give it meaning by giving it a name and then studying it. We find out there's stars and galaxies and this sort of thing. So information is just patterns of energy. And if you look at your newsprint on your newspaper, or daily newspaper, and you see the written language, that's just a pattern of information or pattern of energy.
Like symbolism?
It's a symbolism. Yes,
mm-hmm.
It is a symbol to which either we give meaning or whoever put it there gave it meaning. And we have to decipher it. But information is a pattern of energy.
By that, I guess you would mean, just for my listeners who might not quite understand that, is tell me if this is what you mean. Say, for example, if we wrote the letters R-E-D, those letters are symbolic for the color red.
Mm-hmm.
But without the color red being next to those letters, R-E-D, nobody would have any idea what the color red was. Is that what you mean?
Or have it in memory, of course.
Right.
And have it experienced. That is why giving meaning to information is what we do, or we're told, or we learn, or we experience it, and we associate, say, that certain ideas with that information.
What do you believe to be the source of intentionality?
Well, one of the simplest examples is the body. You get thirsty, and you intend to go find a drink.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it is a impulse within the organism to satisfy some desire.
Do you think that there is a higher power that's actually the source of that intent that processes through the binary brain system?
I guess the you're beginning starting to ask the toughest questions that we have in consciousness studies, and that is the deepest nature of consciousness and whether it requires matter or not. And it's really a cosmological question. The cosmological question fundamentally is, who are we, how do we get here, and where are we going, and what's this all about?
Mm-hmm.
And the deepest aspect of that are these very deep questions about consciousness, life after death. Where does consciousness come from, and what is its basic nature? And we really don't have the firm answers to that. We have traditional answers. We have answers out of our theology and our religions. We have answers out of science. But do we really know the answer? No, we do not.
What would your personal opinion be?
Well, starting with what we just said a little while ago,
mm-hmm.
that this quantum correlation corresponds to the most basic and fundamental aspect of awareness that we know about, where one subatomic particle is aware of what happens to another subatomic particle. To me, that is the most fundamental aspect or attribute that we find in consciousness. In other words, being aware.
Mm-hmm.
So we understand that this takes place with packets of energy, and packets of energy also implies particles. So this is happening at the most fundamental level of nature, at this type of awareness. And to me, it takes a more complex organization of matter to have higher levels of consciousness and perception. For example, it's been well demonstrated by a researcher by the name of Cleve Baxter many years ago, over 30 years ago, that simple life forms like plants and amoeba and bacteria have simple awareness. And what we're saying, even subatomic matter has simple awareness, but it doesn't have self-awareness. It doesn't apparently recognize itself as separate from the environment. However, it's rather clear that animals and life forms with brains do have self-awareness, and that they distinguish themselves from the general environment around themselves. And we know that infants of all varieties, when they are first born, they spend a certain amount of time finding out what is themselves and what is not themselves, and what is mama,
mm-hmm.
and what is food, and what is dangerous, and what is a threat, and what is safe. So that is becoming knowledgeable and self-aware. And then we get to higher forms of consciousness, like in the primates and in humans, and we start to see self-reflective awareness, which means we can think about our mental processes or think about our awareness and think about ourselves thinking about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that is self-reflective awareness, which is a more complex form. So to me, in my modeling of this, complexity has a lot to do with it as matter becomes more complex. But building upon that very basic principle of awareness that we see at the quantum level.
Well, I guess one reason, that's one of the reasons that I decided to do this project.
That's what, please, I didn't quite hear that.
I said, that's kind of one of the reasons, those the levels of awareness. You know, I asked somebody not too long ago, what do you think consciousness means? And this was a medical doctor, and he looked at me and he said, well, the opposite of being in a coma. And then that made me start questioning, if we do have three levels of awareness, you know, this insight, cognitive, and self, what would be the minimal level of consciousness that persona or that level of understanding would allow the people to be in the world, like Terry Schiavo, for example? So what would your definition of consciousness be in that regard?
The whole point is that all levels in nature have various aspects of consciousness. I do not think that I just described with self-reflective consciousness the highest level of awareness that we can have. In other words, if we can think about our thinking, then we can say, how about thinking about ourselves thinking about our thinking? And think about ourselves thinking about ourselves thinking about our thinking. And that's called the infinite regress. You could you can push that to a ridiculous extreme, and it takes a lot more ability to hold those ideas in mind than any of us have. The most we humans can do is generally about two or three levels of thinking about ourselves, thinking about our thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Now, using that process, we simply don't know where evolution might take us. I would assume that if we evolve to higher levels, we will find different ways to define consciousness and different levels of expressing it.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the major issues in the world right now. There are so many definitions of consciousness that it's not really understood by a large population of the world. So people are having conversations about wars and about keeping people on life machines, talking about consciousness, and they're having different definitions of that word.
We have not had, science has not addressed itself to the nature of consciousness. Really, a few people have over the past, historically. But science as a discipline of investigation has not addressed itself to the nature of consciousness until the last 30 years. And that has been since the Cartesian times, around Newtonian times, when the philosopher René Descartes, in the church, and as a philosopher and a mathematician, came to the conclusion that body, mind, physicality, and spirituality belong to two independent realms of reality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when that was accepted, what it permitted, or what it caused to happen, was to allow the Inquisition of the Roman Church to get off the backs of the intellectuals and quit burning them to stake for heretical notions, as long as they stayed away from notions of mind and consciousness. So science for almost 400 years has not addressed those questions. And so it's not surprising that medical doctors, only looking at patients that are either dead or alive or conscious or semi-conscious, really don't have much notion of what consciousness is all about. This is a discipline and a study all in itself.
That's true, but it's an important one, don't you think?
Very much. That's why I've spent 35 years of my life looking at it.
What would you believe? Would you believe that consciousness would be contained within a frequency or a field?
Oh, no, I don't. I would limit consciousness to a frequency or a field. I think it is a process, an interactive process. If we say information coming in is perceived and requires attention. Information purposely going out requires intention.
Mm-hmm.
So intention is an outflow of information, and attention requires an inflow of information. But it could be many frequencies and many particles of matter and ideas. So I don't think you can limit it to simply saying it's contained within a frequency. That doesn't fit the definition at all.
Mm-hmm. As it relates to that, I don't know how much you know about me, but I'm a medical intuitive, and it came about quickly, spontaneously after a near-death experience.
That's what I understand. Yes, go ahead.
And for whatever reason, I don't know why, but I'm very focused on frequencies and time, space, pulse intervals, and voltage and amplitude. And I don't know why I seem to be focused on that, but that's just what came in.
It's very important to the healing process, of course.
So I wonder, do you think that information gets encoded, well, the source of creativity, say, or the source of intention is encoded to us in the source of time, space, pulse, intervals?
Well, it can. For example, I have been recently working on a concept called quantum holography, and I have
mm-hmm.
been for several years now, discovered in Europe by colleagues, and he was trying to discover how to improve MRI machines, and he discovered a process, quantum holography. And what that is the fact that all matter, it doesn't matter what matter, all matter, from your body to the desk in front of you to the telephone that we're both talking on, emits and reabsorbs energy at the quantum level.
Mm-hmm.
And those emissions carry information about the history of that bit of matter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the ancients, a long time ago, particularly in the Hindu tradition, talked about the Akashic record, or the record of all events.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that this quantum hologram is precisely a mechanism that allows that to happen. And so it is an informational structure that carries information about matter into what we've used to be the zero-point energy field. And it carries this sort of information. So when intuitives of any sort gather information remotely and at a distance, they're picking up the quantum hologram associated with whatever object you're trying to intuit or trying to get information from.
Mm-hmm.
That is the mechanism that we're now beginning to understand. It's brand new in our understanding, and we don't understand that much about it yet.
For my listeners that may not quite understand, tell me if this is what you're saying. Are you saying that physical reality is a hologram?
That what?
That physical reality is a hologram.
No, I'm not saying that. Physical reality is, that has been said, the universe as a hologram, and I do not think that is true. Physical reality is hard stuff. It's out there. But it emits energy and information in forms of images that some intuitives can see,
mm-hmm.
that is holographic in nature. And
okay.
We do know that Carl Pribram helped us discover over 30 years ago that the brain assimilates holographic information. In other words, information come in into the brain is stored holographically. And so nature uses holograms and holographic information, but it is should not be described as totally and completely just a hologram.
Okay.
Although some which cosmologists think have exercised that and tried to explain it that way.
Well, one of the things that comes into my head that I talk about a lot, well, questions that I ask people about that have more information than me is, obviously we are a field of atoms. Where?
We're what, please?
A field of atoms and energy fields.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And we all know that everything's made up of atoms. And if you broke down everything to the basic molecular structure, the very basic structure that you could break it down to be, it would be a molecule of hydrogen. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. You can break it down into several forms. We can go completely, go deeper than just simply atomic and molecular structure. You go subatomic structure, and you get all of these zoo of subatomic particles that eventually dissolve into just packets of energy.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these form atomic structure, and then greater organization forms molecular structure. And in chemistry, of course, that's what we study, are the various atoms and molecules that we think makes up matter.
It just makes me, well, I don't even get into hydrogen with you. I better stay on topic here. I'll get off topic.
Hydrogen is certainly the most simple, or the most simple molecule that we, or atom, that we encounter.
It makes me think that it's the actual building block of physical reality, and that's why we should go to a hydrogen-based fuel.
I'm sorry, start me again. I'm sorry, I didn't quite get all of that.
I said, it makes me think that it's the building block of physical reality, and that's one reason why we should go to a hydrogen-based fuel to clean up the world. But that's another topic another day.
Certainly, as the simplest atom, and when it combines into its form, it combines with oxygen and makes water, and it's a very powerful and important, hydrogen is a very important element. It's not the only, it's certainly the simplest one, but it's not the only one. We got a lot of them.
Right. You were talking about the Akashic Records a few minutes ago. What is your perspective on karma?
Karma to me is just cause and effect. Generally, all forces, all emotions have some effect. And so. That's the most basic definition of karma. It's the effect resulting from a cause.
What role do you believe karma has regarding manifestation or the lack thereof in physical reality?
Well, I think we generally apply to our behavior patterns and the things that we do. In the Eastern world, karma is pretty well established in certain rules. I think one of the things that happens here in our Western world is we say what goes around comes around.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of expressing karma.
Well, let me ask you about this. What are your thoughts on the manifestation of intent in the physical reality?
Well, I think we have pretty well demonstrated that intentionality causes physical effects. And Dean Radin, who is at Petaluma, the Institute of Neurotic Sciences, which I founded along with Marilyn Schlitz, have been doing a great deal of study on the role of intentionality and the role of attention in causing physical effects, and we know this happens.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's been very well documented over many decades now of experiment. The problem is we still do not have a very good idea within science and mathematics how to properly model how intentionality takes place. Although, certainly if we're going to do healing, alternative forms of healing,
mm-hmm.
It's very clear that that's what is happening. And that's been witnessed and worked with enough that there's no doubt that what it occurs, and that some people are very, very competent at it. And I have been had healing in that way myself. I've witnessed it and observed it and studied it for years, but we still don't know precisely how to model that interaction. It does require a quantum resonance, I am convinced, between the healer and the patient. And we can go that far in modeling, but we still don't have what I consider the end model to all of this. still an open question.
Go ahead.
It's still an open question as to properly how to properly model this.
One of the things, you know, that people, I'm going to say that I align with you on your beliefs because I do. But a lot of the resistance that I get when I talk to people about manifestation of intent, they say, well, if it's real, why can't I manifest a car in front of me right now?
Because you're kind of trained in it. and it takes a lot of practice to do that.
And let me tell you what I think about that and see what you think about this. I tell them that I believe that whatever you intend on, if it's focused enough and cohesive enough thought, you manifest whatever it is that you think. It may take some time. It may take a decade because things don't happen overnight. But I think that it comes somewhere, and we don't put longitude or latitude, and I'm just using this for the general reference so the listeners will understand. It comes somewhere in the world,
well,
and you have to find it.
What you're saying, and I totally agree, to a certain extent, we create our own reality in the very way you're talking about. If we focus on it and concentrate on it, we're likely to cause things like that to happen. Now, it's very hard. We're not skilled enough yet to be terribly precise and able to always manifest what we like in the time frame that we'd like to manifest it. But be assured, we do create many aspects of our own reality.
And would you agree that we're living now what we manifested within the last, say, 10 years or so?
More than likely.
Yeah. And I guess this is what I was trying to focus on when I was asking if you thought that karma had anything to do with it. You know, a lot of times you can intend all you want to, but it doesn't happen. And I believe it's because of some karma. Like if you're in, say, you're poor and you focus and focus and focus on money and it doesn't come, do you believe there's some karmic thing? You are where you are because that's where you're supposed to be for what you're supposed to learn in this life.
Well, I tend to think that somewhat along those lines, but I'm a little bit more here now pragmatic than that, is that we have to, in a sense, clean up our act within ourselves. We have to find peace and self within. We have to start to try to reach a transcendent experience. Let me jump to a saying right out of our Christian literature. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and all the rest will be added unto you. There's in all traditions, there is that type of idea that you first need to get right with yourself and get in right action. And the rest comes along pretty naturally.
And for my listeners' benefit, are you saying that you must live in the moment and accept where you are and what you are as being that perfect thing in your life and not worry about what was 5 minutes ago or what might be 5 minutes from now?
Well, I wouldn't say it quite that way. I certainly think we should learn from our mistakes because we all make mistakes and try to correct our behaviors in the future. But by and large, learning to be in tune with ourselves and find peace within and find the happiness within. Happiness is not brought to us by external objects. Happiness is brought to us when we find peace within ourselves. And that message has been aptly demonstrated over and over again.
Yes, it has. Well, let me ask you this.
Okay.
There are several definitions to free will, I believe.
Okay.
One would be, I can turn left at the intersection if I want to. Another one would be, I am going to the grocery store tomorrow. You have free will to do that. But in actuality, you have no free will to get there because you cannot guarantee that you're going to get to the grocery store. You may have a wreck. You may have a phone call. Somebody might get sick. Do you believe that consciousness in physical reality, that free will exists?
Well, we certainly have choice. There's no question about it. We have choice. But we can't always manifest everything we choose. But I don't even like to use the word free will. I just use the word we have choice. And we choose and we make decisions, and those decisions have consequences. And we generally have to live with those consequences and learn from the ones that don't work out.
Do you, are you of the opinion that we are in a state of duality?
Well, what do you define that word as? You're using it for me, because that word is used in many ways.
I guess what I'm saying is I kind of feel like we're not driving this car known as a physical body. It's kind of like we're sitting in the back seat in one of those little car seats for a three-year-old with a little yellow steering wheel, and we think we're driving this car. But when we get it down the street to the playgrounds on the right and the drugstores on the left, if source or the source of intention or the source of creativity means to go to the grocery store, the drugstore, we're going to the grocery store, and at that point we find out that we're not driving the car.
Well, I can't say that I really agree with that, the way you're saying it. We certainly have subconscious intentions. We have things going on in our subconscious mind that manifest that we're not truly conscious of. And quite often they do the controlling, but it's still within our own complex of thought and thinking that's doing the controlling. And sometimes you're picking up on non-local information that your body wants to act upon. You get impulses and intuitions about, and you act upon that. But that is why I say the most important thing is getting in tune with myself and getting at peace with oneself. And I think that I think when you do that, you start to feel far more in control of yourself.
Another question I'd like to ask you about is healing machines.
Is what, please?
Healing machines. You know, like the Rife technology?
Yes, like the Rife technology.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, you know, energy is meant to be exact? If you give a light bulb too much energy, it pops, and if you don't give it enough, you know, it's not bright enough.
I did not get clearly what you just said.
Oh, I said, you know, energy is meant to be exact. If you give light bulb too much energy, it pops.
Okay.
If you don't give it enough, it's too dim. So I would imagine that each one of our organs vibrate at a specific frequency if it's at its optimal. And people use these Rife machines, and I know some of them go up to like 80,000 hertz. Do you think that when using those machines that the energy should be exact, or does it matter that it fluctuate up and down to 80,000 hertz, say somebody's uterus vibrates at 26,563.68?
I look at it somewhat significantly differently than that. It would appear that the Rife machine does work in many cases. I have not studied the Rife machine long enough to consider myself an expert in it. On the other hand, one of the things that does seem to work, and I need to use holographic explanations again, is that each organ, a healthy organ, puts out a particular pattern of energy, a holographic pattern,
mm-hmm.
and a diseased organ will put out a different one. And if you can have a machine, or if in perceiving the healing process, you can distinguish between the frequencies involved in a diseased organ and a healthy organ. In principle, if you would send an anti-wave or a reverse wave representing the diseased organ, the difference in it, then that would be a healing modality. And essentially, the Rife machine doesn't just put out a single frequency. It puts out a number of frequencies. And the more sophisticated machines do that, which center on sending the reverse wave, as it were, or the anti-wave associated with a diseased organ. And I think that that may very well be the methodology of the future that we will learn to use better.
Do you think that a person's level, we have an aura around us that's an electromagnetic field. Do you think that this frequency of that field being different in each person would make a difference in the frequency of their organs, or would the organs vibrate at the same speed regardless?
There's individual differences. Yes, I would think so.
I would too. It would be logical, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that's about our hour today, Doctor. And I tell you, I thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
It means a lot to me because I think the topic of consciousness is something that the world needs to address, if for no other reason, to have peace in the world.
Well, we not only have to have peace in the world, we have to get ourselves acting right because at the moment, we're not on a sustainable path with civilization.
That's right. And do you believe that our intent makes a difference in the mass consciousness of the world?
Of course. Of course it does. But we have to understand the problem, and that's a matter of education and a matter of understanding the various systems that are going on here. And there's a new book out by Lester Brown of World Watch that is called Plan B, Part 2, which is a way toward moving toward sustainability before it's too late. And we're going to have to...
Do you have an opinion on what that timeline is?
Well, according to the best numbers we see, things are going to get progressively worse. In the next 10 to 15 years, it's likely we will reach peak oil or start to use up the oil supply on Earth. We have to have alternative energy sources. Our consumerism, the populations of both China and India are increasing, and their consumption pattern will outstrip the United States right now. The United States is the heaviest consumer of energy and most every other thing in the world. And in another 15 to 20 years or so, both India and China, who are trying to industrialize and improve their lifestyles, if they model the consumption patterns of the United States, the world will not be able to sustain it for any length of time.
I think you're right. Agape, Dr. Mitchell, and thank you so much for coming on today.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.